Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today we celebrate our annual day of Thanksgiving, although for many millions of Americans, this might be a last banquet to be thankful at the cusp of an avowed inquisition. But what exactly is there for us to be thankful for? Remember that our Thanksgiving is the result of stealing a continent away from civilizations which we buried and whose descendants we continue to treat with much less than benign contempt. Remember that our intrusion decimated ages-old forests, wiped out entire species of wildlife, and continue to render others close to extinction. Remember, we made slaves of a race we have never quite freed, nor permitted equality. Donald Trump's presidential transition team is already talking about concentration camps for millions of American citizens and inhabitants they regard as deplorables, to borrow a term, 2 months before formal inauguration of the Trump Reich, using as an ugly precept the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, most of whom were citizens. The private prison industry might serve as the new concentration camps. However, it should be noted that the first internment camps in this country are called Indian reservations. The intolerable police violence and governmental disregard for indigenous rights of the United Tribes and their non-native allies who are protesting the destruction of sacred sites and protecting their water source, endangered by construction of the Standing Rock oil pipeline in North Dakota, is not only a probable preview of life in the new Trump states of Trumpica, that's with a K, and a warning of worse to come for any dissent against the anticipated official sanction of misogyny, bigotry, and xenophobia. It is also the origin story of our history, the founding genocide that underlies today's national celebration. The great cartoonist Ron Cobb once drew a Thanksgiving feast above the splintered bones of dead indigenous people. Today's program begins with a comprehensive view of the continuing oppression against Native Americans by the late John Mohawk, legendary editor of the Mohawk Nation newspaper, Akwesasne Notes. Native Americans and the Right to Survive by John Mohawk. The white man made us many promises, but he kept only one. He promised to take our land, and he took it. And that's a quote from Red Cloud in 1882. It should be clear to anyone familiar with the history of the United States-Indian relations that it is U.S. policy to destroy the native peoples as peoples. U.S. law and policy has made some room for the idea that native people may have some, albeit limited, rights to property, and they may have some rights to a religion, maybe even some theoretical rights to a culture, by whatever vague definitions those terms are interpreted. But the United States has never recognized native rights to be a distinct people. The policies of the United States and their English-speaking forebears has been characterized by a consistent denial of the rights of native peoples to exist. Even into the 20th century, we found policies which remove native children from their families and communities, promote sterilization of native women, practice acculturation through alien school systems, and implant foreign systems of government in the Indian country to legitimize the alienation of the land base and to destroy the existing social order. All of those are acts and policies which have the net effect of destroying the native peoples as peoples. They have been acts which have been inflicted and which continue to inflict untold misery and suffering upon hundreds of thousands of innocent victims. The destruction of native peoples as peoples is part of a much larger program of the United States. It may not be possible in the long run to bring the outrageous wrongs done to the Indian peoples to bear on the conscience of the American population, because only a very small percentage of the American people seem capable of understanding the immensity of the crime of destroying the spirit and physical reality of a whole people. Some Americans are capable of understanding the process in terms of the effects of U.S. policies in terms of race. Others see it in terms of the destruction of a group's property rights, and a few are offended that the policies destroy families. A smaller number of people are alarmed at the fact that these same policies will almost certainly destroy the remaining native cultures, just as similar policies have already destroyed dozens, perhaps hundreds, native cultures in the past. The history and present condition of native peoples is a dismal tale indeed. Most of our nations face extinctions as peoples during this century. It doesn't seem to help that by and large, the international community has adopted a morality which holds that it is a violation of human decency and the spirit of international law for a nation state to commit acts which are intended to destroy groups of national, ethnical, and or religious identity. International compacts on genocide forbid acts which result in physical or mental harm to groups, peoples, such as native peoples. Governmental policies that are designed to destroy such peoples are clearly contradictory to the spirit of such international conventions. The United States, through its representatives to the international community, simply denies it commits any acts of genocide. How they can do this with a straight face is simply incredulous. They would deny that their policy since 1784 has been the destruction and absorption of native peoples. Would they deny that they have policies which take Indian land, Indian children, and which have as an expressed purpose the dismemberment of native communities? The representatives of the United States would tell you that things have changed since Colonel Chivington and his troops butchered innocent women and children at Sand Creek. Things are getting better. It is possible to agree that things have changed, but it is highly doubtful that the prospects for the survival of Native peoples as peoples are getting any better. The single prospective positive change on the horizon, the one which offers some faint shimmer of hope, hasn't even begun to penetrate the marble halls of government. But that possibility of change has made its first appearance in American culture. It could signal the most profound change in many centuries. 4 or 5 centuries ago, when European peoples first came to the Americas, changes in cultures were triggered, which were to alter the course of history. The medieval adventurers who sought trade routes to the Orient belonged to a culture which even most Europeans have difficulty recalling. The Spanish and English of the early 16th century had evolved a culture that claimed that all knowledge of the world was contained essentially within two sources, the Bible and the philosophies of Aristotle. When the Spanish first returned to Europe with tales of landings in strange lands, it was several years before it became widely believed that what had been found was actually a new land, a new world. Columbus thought he had discovered India. He called the people Indians, because it was widely believed that the known world was the whole world. To suggest that a continent and a people existed that were not mentioned in the Bible was something akin to heresy, and the customs of the time dealt harshly with heretics. Soon enough, however, it became obvious that the Americas were indeed a new world, a world not described in either the Bible or the wisdom of Aristotle. That discovery set off events of enormous impact in Europe. American Indians were not supposed to exist, but they were undeniably real. Frantic biblical scholars sought to prove that the Indians were a lost tribe of Israel in an effort to preserve the spiritual and moral universe of the medieval world. It was a theory which would be found in scholarly works into the 20th century, and one which was revived by Joseph Smith and incorporated into the Book of Mormon. But the psychological universe of the medieval world was doomed. Something began to happen in Europe following the discovery of the Americas. There occurred on a massive scale that can only be described as a crisis in faith. It didn't happen overnight, but happen it did. The Americas and the Indians were living proof that not all knowledge lies in the Bible, that neither the Bible nor the Pope were infallible. The age of reason was upon the world, and things would never be the same. All over Europe, groups arose proclaiming themselves to be agnostics and even atheists. Martin Luther tacked his 96 theses to a chapel door, Others scanned the heavens with telescopes, and the Puritans fled Amsterdam so that their children would not be corrupted by the liberal thoughts of their Dutch neighbors. The discovery of the Americas led to great changes in European thought in other ways also. European traders and missionaries, especially the French and English, traveled among North America's native nations, most notable the Algonquins and the Iroquois. Jesuit missionaries partially financed their exploits through what were received as adventure stories, the Jesuit Relations. On several occasions, the early Jesuits saw native people had no recourse to falsehoods, and they were generally open and generous to a fault. A few of them saw native people who valued human relationships far above material things, and they recognized that here was a whole people who practiced the teachings of Jesus as they, the Jesuit missionaries, understood those teachings. And they realized, too, that a people of such nobility, the term noble savage, arose from that experience, could not survive in the modern world. The early Jesuits feared that native people would only be corrupted and destroyed by contact with civilization, and their writings set the stage for an image of native peoples that persists to this day. English-speaking missionaries, on the other hand, viewed native people quite differently. A number of them came to the Americas to escape the ravages, as they say of it, of the modern world in their homeland, and to preserve the morality, at least, of medieval Europe. They practiced a fundamentalist, literal, interpretation of the Bible and saw the native people as demons of the forests, messengers and cohorts of the devil who must be destroyed at all costs. Suffice it to say that the annihilation of the Indians of Massachusetts and Connecticut also left the pious followers of God in possession of vast amounts of Indian land. Increase Mather and his followers set to the task of putting to the sword all those Indians within reach, and English colonists generally carved a history of blood and gore from the Atlantic seaboard to Appalachian Mountains and into the valleys of what is now New York State, where they encountered the military organization of the Six Nations. The mingling with native peoples was to continue to have profound effects on European thought. French explorers in the Algonquin country returned home with stories of the egalitarian societal organization of the Indians, which would later have great influence on the thinking of such men as Montaigne and Rousseau. English colonists, most notably Benjamin Franklin, attended meetings with the Iroquois and were impressed by the concepts of balance of power in government and learned much about principles, if not practice, of democracy. In fact, there is much evidence to suggest that much of the U.S. Constitution was based on organization principles learned from contact with native peoples, especially the Iroquois. While all that was happening, the belief system of Europeans was changing rapidly. In the 15th century, current scholars could engage in serious debate over how many angels could rest on the head of a pin. By the 19th century, philosophers were debating the morality of a fairly new religion, science. The endless Sunday sermons of the Protestant preachers were increasingly supplemented during the week by lessons in reading, writing, arithmetic, and science. By the middle of the 1800s, engineering had become a respectable occupation. Science became a religion which was eventually rivaled by no others. Within 100 years of the general acceptance of the steam engine, more people believed, truly believed, in the principles of chemistry than adhered to any particular sectarian Christian religion. With the widespread advent of compulsory education in the Christian world, science, and even social science, effectively replaced most of the beliefs about the nature of the world which had been held by medieval peoples. Christianity survived because it adapted, but the system of belief known as science and technology flourished. That science and technology became belief systems and not purely disciplines is still only vaguely understood. As European technology promoted, in fact required, rapid expansion into every corner of the globe, there arose expectations that in science and technology, humanity's systematic exploitation of nature, lie all hopes for the future. When the forest grew thin, technology provided cheap and plentiful coal for home heating. When the coal became almost unbearably dirty, technology provided oil and natural gas. The process led to the discovery of nuclear power, the promise of continuing supplies of power when the gas and oil ran out. Cheap and plentiful fuel forever was the promise of nuclear power in the 1950s. Today, the Navajo people are witness to the invasion of their lands and the destruction of their way of life in the name of that brand of progress. Millions of Americans sat at their television sets in the spring of 1979 and watched the plumes of steam rise from a disabled nuclear reactor at Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and wondered, many for the first time, where this road goes. The Navajos at Crown Point, New Mexico, at least the traditional Navajos, already knew where it goes. In Spain, miners used to take caged canaries down into the mine shafts. When the canaries fell dead, the men scrambled out of the mine, knowing that invisible, odorless gases were present and that those gases were deadly. The native peoples, through no fault of their own, are functioning as the miners' canaries of the world. They have been the first victims of every technological disaster. They were the first to suffer in North America from mercury poisoning, arsenic poisoning, fluoride poisoning, and a host of other similar problems. The Navajo and Laguna Pueblo miners who have died and are dying of lung cancer are the first victims of the nuclear fuel cycle. It is an irony that the traditional native peoples have never shared in European belief systems because they have most often been the victims of those systems. As a result, they know that the blind belief in technology will destroy, not save, the peoples of the world, and that they will be among the first to be destroyed. That kind of thinking today is a form of heresy. There continue to be arguments about religion, the nature of God, the interpretation of Scripture, but there are few who question the dogmas of which surround science or technology. The technological revolution has been at the root of the genocide against native peoples throughout the world. Just as the missionaries of the 18th century sought and carried out the slaughter of the native peoples in the name of the moral commandments of God, so do the new missionaries of industrial technology seek the destruction of native peoples in the name of progress, education, economic development, and energy policy. Just as a whole society once lost faith in the teachings of Aristotle and the scriptures as the fountainhead of all knowledge, American society today could well lose faith in that religious faith which holds that massive energy technologies and massive industrial development are the keys to the salvation of the peoples of the world. There seems to be a potential at this time for some new revolutions in thought. The native cultures offer a kind of progress that stands in stark opposition to the materialism of the West. Native spiritualism is the worldview which places a subjective interpretation of the human relationship to the natural world. Native spiritualism carries within it an understanding that all forms of life are sacred and require a great deal of human support, and that in the absence of that support, all life will suffer, including human life. Trees, to the native people, are living and valued beings, and not so many board feet of lumber. As much as anything else, materialism has brought Western man to the brink of ecological disaster. That materialism has deep roots in the West. It emerges from the earliest pages of European history and spans the life of Christianity. Since time immemorial in the West, living things and the things that support life, water, plants, etc., have been viewed as objects to be transformed and consumed. The native people have a potential to bring a consciousness of an alternative way of relating to the world. The traditional native peoples need the support of those who understand the grave conditions of our time if the process of the rape of the land and the people who inhabit the land is to cease. And the West, as equally as desperately, needs a new vision of the future, which includes a promise of the survival of the species. The first step in the battle for the survival of the planet requires that the rights of the traditional native peoples to survive as peoples be supported and recognized, and that the policies of cultural and physical genocide be stopped. and that was, by John Mohawk, Native Americans and the Right to Survive. John Mohawk was a Seneca, born into the Turtle Clan on a New York Iroquois reservation. He was a historian, writer, and visionary who played a singularly important role in fashioning a bridge between traditional Native American culture and international indigenous communities. He was editor and contributor to Atwi Sasni News Notes and Indian Country Today, and author of several books. He died in 2006 at the age of 61. And now, I would like to read A Rarity of Totems by W. M. Itman, Jr. There is so very little left of those who came before. Who would imagine as they look around today at the estuary lowlands, the hills beyond, the steep headlands and the beaches, that it was once so very different than it is now? Ours is but a speck of time, a grain of sand on a windswept beach. That is how quickly and how totally change can be effected. The part of the Oregon coast we call Clatsop and Tillamook counties is the southernmost reach of cultural, social, and spiritual pre-European fabric of life that extended all the way north to Alaska, and which had its roots in Siberia and Northeast Asia in Neolithic times. This is, technically speaking, the region of the Northwest Coast Indian tribes and that of the Eskimos of the North. Relative to the span of humanity's time on Earth, it is, even in its origins, a fairly recent development. The Indians who lived here were descendants of the last migrants from Asia. They intermingled with Indian tribes that had come earlier and moved to the coastal regions from the eastern plains and woodlands of the Great Basin area. With this blended heritage, they flourished in a veritable Garden of Eden before the fall, for centuries before the white sails cut their horizon and ultimately their lives. An absence of recorded literature or chronicles, scarcity of archaeological data, and a very great paucity of artifacts which predate the end of the 18th century leave us very little to go on. What we have learned is legend, myth, oral tradition, and the somewhat biased accounts of the earliest white visitors to these shores. There are a scattered few works of art and artifacts from these earliest contacts, mainly housed in British and European museums today. These material objects are the mute surviving clues that link the richer, later cultural manifestations of the 19th century with finds from the distant and mysterious middens, inhabited sites, and burial places that seem to indicate shadowy interconnections between the peoples of the coastal rainforests with the subarctic and finally with Siberia and northern Manchuria. There are also certain stone and bone objects from parts of present-day British Columbia and the Columbia River Gorge that are of considerable age and which have survived due to the nature of their material. One of the most distinctive aspects of the art of the Indians of the Northwest Coast is the fact that during the century between the visit of Captain James Cook in the 1770s to Nootka Sound in British Columbia and the late 19th century, there was a dazzling burst of creative and artistic energy among the coastlines of the region between Vancouver Island and the Bering Sea. This is somewhat contrary to the usual pattern. Traditionally, a tribal culture does not survive, much less proliferate, prosper, and produce upon contact with white European culture. Therefore, to have expressed in visual terms its pride, its beliefs, and its heritage in an array of sculpturally magnificent and powerful forms, ranging little shamani charms to huge totem poles, all with the aid of trade goods and tools, is exceptional. The rich and powerful empires of the Aztec and the Inca were swept away in less than a lifetime, and much of the strange and fantastic tribal cultures of this hemisphere and the South Pacific Islands was obliterated with a dismay and rapid thoroughness that boggles the mind. The distance between aesthetic excellence and ethnographic majesty and airport art is painfully short. For a variety of reasons, the great artists and artisans of the proud tribes of Tlingit, Shishimon, Bella Bella, Bella Coola, Qualicola, and the Nootka were able to assimilate trade trade goods from the white visitors and incorporate them and the new metal tools to such advantage, they produced a progression of works of art that stands comparison with the art of any culture in the history of humanity on earth. Eventually, white European diseases, religion, education, and law took their inevitable toll. By the time the noted photographer Edward S. Curtis came to record the art and life of the peoples of the Northwest Coast and Alaska, he had to stage the majority of photographs because so few of the old Indians and their old ways were still in evidence. English-speaking Christian Indians from the canneries and paved streets of Canadian fishing villages, dressed in the garments and masks of their grandfathers and grandmothers, to perform for Curtis's camera the then outlawed rites of the potlatch and the nearly forgotten winter dances that had once been the glory of their culture. So even the record left us by Curtis has much to do with our own stubborn early 20th century popularization of the old Indian way of life. Closer to this region and our own time, there is a collection of works of art and artifacts that is of extraordinary richness and quality, formed by Alex Rasmussen, a Norwegian-American who lived in Alaska in the 1920s and 30s. It is now housed in a fairly nonchalant manner in the Portland Art Museum, in dirty and dusty cases which mute the piercing forms, the stylized shapes, and the rich textures. Much of the collection is in storage, and some of it has been dispersed. The politics and policies of the museum are not at issue here. The part of the Rasmussen collection on display is fantastic. Though diminished by the butterfly under glass syndrome and ignored and forgotten by too many of the people who live in this region, the collection contains a considerable number of perfectly beautiful artifacts that speak volumes in their incomprehensible tongues of the way things once were. Much of the collection is published in an excellent little book by the noted anthropologist, Dr. Edna Gunther. Unfortunately, no such treasure trove of works exist for the art of the Indians of this southernmost portion of the region. The majority of the pieces in Portland come from Vancouver Island, north to Alaska. It must be remembered that the tribes of this area, along with the Washington and Oregon coasts, were far fewer in numbers and far less active, and they evolved in ways that were not conducive to the production of an elaborate and sophisticated visual art. Also, for the most part, the coastal tribes of this area were all but extinguished by disease and expropriation soon after arrival of the coastal pioneers. They were, nonetheless, distant cousins to their virtuoso neighbors to the north and shared a markedly similar mythological, social, and racial heritage. There was some degree of trade in smaller goods along the coast and on the Columbia River well before the arrival of white settlers, so that similar trinkets of shell, bone, and trade beads are found up and down the coast in old village sites, regardless of their former tribal occupation. The recorded early contacts between the Lewis and Clark party with local Indians and occasional subsequent intermingling between the two cultures in the early days seem far away now. The few artifacts that come from this region are scattered about in local museums and private collections, and they offer only the slimmest clues of what was here before. But it needn't be so far away. They left names and foot trails scattered along our maps. The elk and deer still walk the dunes and what's left of the forest at night. A hawk and an eagle can still be seen with patience, and when one sees a cloven footprint on the sand at dawn, it makes sandcastles and internal combustion engine traffic on the beach seem nothing more than chaff in the wind. And that was A Rarity of Totems by W.M. Ittman. Bill Ittman is a former art director of Clatsop Community College, and he wrote A Rarity of Totems for the North Coast Times-Eagle. And this has been Michael McCusker. In case you are unaware, KMUN is holding a special one-day pledge drive on Tuesday, November 29th. And I close with a thought for this day of gluttony from a Japanese monk of the 16th century, Takuwan Soho. No day comes back again. One inch of time is worth a foot of jade. Happy Thanksgiving.